This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh announced this morning that the largest school district in the state will move to fully remote learning starting tomorrow. That means the highest needs learners who've been in Boston public school buildings will be going home. Here's Mayor Walsh speaking with WBUR earlier today.
The superintendent and her team are working on a plan to provide services. We're obviously going to continue the food delivery and the food pickup sites for every single family, every single day. And we fought to keep all of our in-person option alive.
For details, we turn to WBUR's Carrie Young. Carrie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
Okay, so Carrie, less than 2 weeks ago, Mayor Walsh was locked in a legal battle with teachers to keep at least some kids learning in person. So what changed? How did he come to this decision?
Yeah, it seems like the deciding factor here was those infection rates and the fact that they've been steadily increasing. Numbers had moved beyond that 4% mark, which was sort of that initial high risk designation mark. And now they're quickly getting closer to 6%. They're just under 6% this week. And that seems to be a really critical number for public health officials here. So with our numbers approaching that level, city leaders felt like the risks were just getting too high.
All right. So the teachers union had sought an injunction in early October after Mayor Walsh delayed the next phase of hybrid learning due to the positivity rates that you mentioned. But at that time, the mayor left students who are already learning in the building in place. Can you remind us of the details of how that part unfolded?
Yeah. So what happened there was the Boston Teachers Union had argued that in their memorandum of understanding with the district, which is an official agreement, that was what they needed to be able to go back to work when schools reopened. They argued that in that agreement, it said that if infection rates hit 4% or higher, teachers should have the option to teach from home. So when the rates did go above 4% a couple weeks ago, the district decided to continue moving forward with their plan of having high need students in class and, requiring staff there. So in the end, the judge said that, if the Boston Public Health Commission determines that teaching in person can still be done safely, even if it's at or like right around 4%, that the district can compel its teachers to come in. The sort of deciding factor there, according to the judge, was that, this is also what the city had argued, was that, both sides agreed to let the Boston Public Health Commission act as a referee in times like these. And since that commission did say, yes, it can still be done safely, that at the time they decided to move forward. And obviously, we are at a time that it's moved beyond that 4% pretty significantly. Now, WBUR did get a chance to interview Mayor Walsh just a little bit ago to ask more about, this reversal decision, especially after taking the, time and effort to fight this in court to keep kids in the classroom. And here's what he had to say.
We went to court last week to keep our high needs students in classroom. We felt at that point we could provide education to them and services that they get in a safe manner. When you get to a 5.7, nearly 6% infection rate, it gets a little more tricky. And I'd rather err on the side of caution. I'm not going to gamble with our kids.
So, Carrie, the announcement just happened this morning, but it goes into effect tomorrow, less than 24 hours. That is a huge scramble for people. What are you hearing from parents, from teachers?
Yeah, I'm hearing just that this is definitely like a really, it's a scramble. It's a dramatic shift in such a, short period of time that people are going to have to get used to. I spoke with one father today, Jack Sinnott. Two of his kids have IEPs at BPS. And he told me today that it's really hard for him to stay hopeful that his kids will continue to grow in their education and to continue learning this year. He says, right now with them at home, it's taking a tremendous amount of effort to just keep them from regressing. Here's how he explains his feelings today.
It's jarring. We've been jolted out of what little complacency we've had about the return to normal. The interventions that are provided by the schools are absolutely critical, not merely to our kids progressing and advancing, but just holding in place.
I also talked to a teacher today, Caroline Alexis. She's a special education teacher in the Boston Public School System. And she, you know, she says that she totally understands why the decision was made, you know, especially with the safety concerns. Safety is a concern of hers as well. But she says, you know, at the same time, she's got a lot of concerns about her students and their families being able to adapt to now having to be back at home with remote learning, especially after, you know, being in the classroom for a little while. And especially, like, as you mentioned, that one day's notice, she's a little bit worried about how families are going to be able to adjust their schedules.
There are families who are going to scramble. I'm concerned about students being home alone if their families don't have anyone to call right now.
So let's follow on to the parent you just talked about, Carrie. There was a reason that Mayor Walsh fought to keep students who were considered high priority learning, students learning English as a second language, those who had special education needs, learning in person. So there must be concerns now about sending those students home for fully remote learning.
Yes. I mean, the concern is very, very high among parents and even groups like the Boston Special Education Parent Advisory Council. I spoke with the group's chair today, Roxy Harvey, and, you know, she, you know, also took the tone of like, yes, safety first. She totally understands. But she says, you know, there are students who just can't learn remotely, especially in these high needs populations. And she says they really need a lot more support and services than what remote learning can provide. So here's a little bit more of how she spoke to this.
So we really do need to work with our district and come up with a plan for them to continue to get services, because the focus needs to remain on what these children need to be able to flourish, because they cannot continue to regress due to lack of services.
One interesting thing that Harvey told me on the phone today was that her group is actively working with the district to find ways to continue getting students with very high needs some kind of service, you know, whether that's in their homes or like finding some sort of very restricted, protected environment in a school building or some kind of, you know, different setting. They're still working all of that out. So those conversations are all happening. We don't know what that's going to turn out to be, but those conversations are happening. So I'll be interested to follow up on what they come up with there.
Carrie, we know the district has said that students will remain fully remote until, quote, infection rates decrease, unquote. So what does that mean? Is there a clear metric that the city's going to use?
Yeah, right now there is a clear metric that it looks like we're aiming for. According to city leaders, high-need students will be able to return to in-person learning after infection rates fall below 5% for 2 weeks. And then they'll return to their like regular phase-in plan and move forward with all that after those infection rate numbers fall to 4% or below. So we still have a little ways to go, but we have some like solid numbers to aim towards.
Well, we appreciate you giving us the details, and we'll continue to watch this with you. That's Carrie Young, WBUR's Edify reporter. Carrie, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, for the first time in his papacy, Pope Francis has endorsed same-sex civil unions and called for legal protections for same-sex families. He did so while being interviewed for a documentary film called Francesco, which premiered today at the Rome Film Festival. Time magazine reported that in a sit-down interview for the film, the Pope said, quote, "Homosexual people have a right to be in a family. They are children of God," end quote. And the Pope goes on to say their life should not be made miserable and that we need a civil union law. Now, the implications of the Pope's statements are unclear, as there is a difference between interview remarks and official church teaching. But still, how are you reacting to this, whether you're Catholic or not? What do you think this means for the church, for the LGBTQ community, and for society as a whole? We welcome your thoughts. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here to help us consider what this could mean for the Catholic community in the Commonwealth and beyond, first we have Thomas Groom, professor of theology and religious education at Boston College. Tom is past director of the Church in the 21st Century Center and also author of Faith for the Heart, A Catholic Spirituality. And also with us is Marianne Duddy Burke, executive director of Dignity USA, an organization of Catholics working for LGBTQIA equality. Tom and Marianne, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
It's great to be with you both.
Thank you, Marianne.
And listen, as we jump into this conversation, Tom and Marianne, I just want to acknowledge I was president of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston from 2007 to 2010. All right, so as is so often the case with big and sometimes ambiguous news, I think I just want to start by asking from each of your perspectives, how big is this? Tom, how big a deal is this?
Well, you know, Tiziana, as Joe Biden said the other night, when the Pope or when the president speaks, what the president says matters. And likewise in spades, really, what the Pope says for Catholics really, really matters. So it is significant that the Pope would do this and say this. Now, he has said things somewhat like this before and so on, but I don't think he's ever come out as Pope in favor of civil unions before. So at least it looks like it's a step in the right direction, but I'm anxious to hear what Marianne would think of it.
Go ahead, Marianne.
Yeah, our position is that we are very cautiously optimistic about this statement at the moment. As Tom rightly notes, you know, there have been positive sounding statements on LGBTQ issues in the past, which have then been clarified or walked back a bit by the Vatican. So I think that we're kind of at the beginning of the story here. We're just in the first chapter. And we're going to have to wait and see what the response of the Vatican is to all of the reports. And personally, I really would like to see the whole context of these remarks in the film before coming to a final conclusion. That having been said, if these remarks stand, it could be an international revolution for LGBTQ people.
Yes.
I want to underscore a note that you both struck just there. The Pope has said similar things before. I'm going to play you some sound here from 2016. He's talking about it during an in-flight press conference on the way back from Azerbaijan. Here he is.
Le persone si devono accompagnare come li accompagna Gesù. Quando una persona...
Now, obviously, he's speaking in Italian there, but the Pope says, quote, we must accompany people like Jesus would. When this person comes before Jesus, he will never leave you because you are homosexual. No, end quote. So we know the Pope has said similar things before. Is there something substantively different as we understand it, Tom, in what he said this time in 2020?
Well, I think his emphasis, Tiziana, on everybody is a child of God. Like, in a sense, this is absolutely non-negotiable Catholic faith. I mean, this is constitutive of our faith. Anybody who says otherwise is in heresy. In other words, it goes back to the first book of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, that and God made humankind in God's own image and likeness, and all are made in the image and likeness of God. Nobody is any more or less than anybody else. So he's all of that we know already, and he has said things like it before, and yet he made it central, it seemed to me, as I read this the report, and that being children of God gives us all a right to a family. So I don't think he's saying anything that he hasn't said before, but I think it does have a new emphasis, and I think we have to take it very seriously, because it's not just the opinion of this Pope. This Pope is articulating what is foundational to our Catholic faith, and that is that all are made in the image and likeness of God, and to say or imply otherwise becomes heretical.
Marianne, I want to parse out here. There is the Pope saying these things in an interview. There is the Pope sustaining these comments in his papal position, and then there is church teaching. I want to stay at the Pope sustaining these comments in his papal position. If he does that, how important are these words for LGBTQ Catholics? What does it mean for their relationship to their church, to the faith?
Well, I think it would be a tremendous sign of inclusion, certainly to LGBTQ Catholics, to our families, but the implications are much broader than that, even. The Vatican has been a key obstacle to passage of legal protections for LGBTQI people all across the globe. And if we are now seeing a signal that that is about to change or has changed or is in the process of changing, people who are in very vulnerable situations in countries where there are no legal protections for queer people, for our families, might start seeing some of those protections come into being, and their lives could change drastically. They could be in much safer position, subject to much less violence. And that's obviously very, very positive. I think it also signals that, you know, if the Vatican is going to stop being an impediment to legal protections for gay people and trans people, will it also be reviewing, revising, removing those horrific church teachings that condemn gay people, that say any same-sex intimacy is intrinsically evil, that are the root of so much of the pain and discrimination our community has faced for so long?
I want to go to the phones here, 1-800-423-8255, to join the conversation. We've got Juan on the line from Haverhill. Juan, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Rita Bolson. And my comment here is that gay people have been married forever. Gay people have been getting married forever. The difference now is that they can marry each other. And with that, you know, the consequences of this is that you're going to have happier families, happier children. I used to be married. I came out. And being able to raise my daughter with being proud of who I am makes a big difference. I think the story would have been horrible if I had been a closeted dad, raising a child, not being able to tell my daughter who I was because of the Catholic Church, of the, you know. So I think this is all great news that the Pope is saying.
Thank you. I really appreciate you calling and sharing how this affects you personally as well. I think that brings this home for us. Tom Groom, I'll turn to you there. There are many steps between what the Pope said and more official action, but let me let you react to Juan.
Okay, and I think we'll take many steps. And one of the steps, and maybe this is a question back to you, Tiziana, because you know it better than I, but my understanding is that, for example, the Archdiocese of Boston refuses to place adoptive children in with gay couples. Now, this statement from the Pope would seem to call for a review of that, because the Pope very explicitly says that they have a right to a family. And if that be true, then should Catholic Charities review that policy they've had? As I understand it, it's still in place, where they refuse to place adoptive children with gay couples. So there'll be all kinds of instances of implications that I think we haven't even begun to tease out yet. But I'm wondering if that might be one for the Archdiocese here.
Yeah, you know, this is something I was going to ask you both about, the implications for organizations, Catholic organizations that also exist in the secular world. You know, to your point, Tom, more than 10 years ago, Catholic Charities in the Archdiocese of Boston, before I became president, stopped its adoption contract with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts because the Vatican found out that Catholic Charities was adopting special needs children to same-sex couples. The Vatican disagreed with that. Catholic Charities could not continue to adopt if it on a state contract if it discriminated, and so the result was that Catholic Charities stopped doing adoptions across the board. And I do wonder, Marianne, for Catholic organizations functioning in the secular world, this, as you say, could really change legal protections, practical human resource policies. How do we begin to think about that?
I think that's really important for us to be considering. At this point, people are being fired if they marry a same-sex partner or if they transition in terms of their gender. If they work for Catholic institutions, including those that get public funding. You know, there's a Supreme Court case being heard the day after election that follows up on this whole issue of adoption rights for same-sex couples, hospital treatment, you know, whether people can live in Catholic long-term care facilities as a same-sex married couples. I mean, the implications are enormous. And all of that could be on the table if we're starting to see progress in this direction, as I hope we are.
Let's go back to the phones here. We've got lots of listeners who would like to share their thoughts on this too. 800-423-8255. Pat in Andover, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yes, I applaud the Pope Francis's declaration today. I was raised Catholic, and it's a very refreshing to hear this, and it's a much needed change with all the strife and controversy that's been going on in the Catholic Church. I don't really go to church anymore, but this really is encouraging.
Thank you, Pat. I appreciate that call. And let's take one more. Let's hear from Jane. And I'm sorry, my screen is cut off. I can't see where you're from, Jane, so maybe you can tell us.
I'm from Northeastern, and I share the same sentiments as Pat. Hallelujah, Pope Francis. Bring it on. Now we just have to get women as priests. So I think this is a great step, especially for the year 2020.
Thank you, Jane. And so that's interesting. So we hear both joy there, Tom Groom, and also with Jane, you know, positing that is this the tip of a wedge to other reforms that more progressive Catholics, and we need to know Catholics are not a monolith, either in the United States or across the globe, that more progressive Catholics have been looking for.
Indiana, as we well know. I suppose it might be foolhardy to get overly enthusiastic or excited about it, but it certainly, as Mary Ann said so well, it's a step in the right direction. And with the help of God and the guidance of the Holy Spirit, the Holy Father will continue to speak out. He is the chief teacher of our Catholic faith and represents it to the world. And it is always to the world, which is something for us to remember. It's not just to Boston or to the United States. Mary Ann said earlier, this could have really significant impact, especially in areas of the world that are not even as far along as we might assume to be by way of gay rights and so on. So it's a positive symbol for sure. Then onward with it, and let's see how it unfolds.
I'd like to grab another call here. We've got John on the line from Roxbury. John, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I just feel that this is a message to America right now, too. The Supreme Court hearings recently, there's many Catholic countries that support gay rights and abortion. And, you know, with this recent Supreme Court hearing that seems to be Catholic is a big deal about being against abortion and gay rights. So I think it fits in that context. So.
Thanks, John. Thank you. Thanks for that call. And Marianne, I'll turn to you on that. And just as a reminder for our listeners, the Senate is in the process of preparing to, it appears, confirm Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who is Catholic, to be a Supreme Court justice. The Republican senators have been very clear that abortion is an issue on the table in this nomination process, and it would make six of the Supreme Court justices Catholic should she be confirmed. So let me turn to you, Marianne, for some reactions there.
Yeah, I'd like to note that Sir Pat and was it Joy, the other caller that spoke?
I think it was Jane.
You know, Jane, I'm sorry.
That's
for
okay.
Getting the name wrong. But I think that what they are showing is how far ahead of church officials Catholics in many countries tend to be in terms of support for LGBTQ rights and for other conscience rights as well. And that does spill over into our public policy arena. I think that folks are really thinking seriously about these intersections of faith and morality and public policy issues. And while these issues are certainly, as you said, not monolithic in any way within our church, I think that people really are really thinking about what human rights look like and what it means to be members of a church or a society together, even when there are differences of opinion.
So, Tom, I'm getting on my call screen a note that the AP had a story this morning with a response from the Bishop of Providence, Rhode Island, Thomas Tobin. And here's part of what he said, quote, "The Pope's statement clearly contradicts what has been longstanding teaching of the church about same-sex unions. The church cannot support the acceptance of objectively immoral relationships," end quote. That underscores not only that there will be wide disagreement inside the church on the Pope's comments, but also that there is a long history of pain for LGBTQ Catholics and non-Catholics alike. In the response to the Catholic Church to the LGBTQ community, and this does not address that history.
No, it doesn't. And Bishop Tobin, I think, in fairness to him, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I think he would be recognized as one of the more conservative, significantly to the conservative right, among Catholic bishops. Like, many of our bishops will not have any negative response to it the way Tobin did. And Tobin is somewhat idiosyncratic in that regard. I was thinking, as we were talking and as Marianne was talking, you know, I was asked one time, why did Ireland pass the marriage rights amendment by 64-65% when only 8-12% of the population is gay or bisexual or LGBTQ? And my answer was, because there may be only 10-12% of the population, but they all have mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers and aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters who hate to see their child or their grandchild discriminated against. So I think there's a basic instinct in parents, of especially if our priests and bishops had families and some of their kids were gay, they would have a lot very different song to sing. In this regard, if you find yourself as a parent of a gay child, you change your mind rather quickly about their rights and their dignity and their equal rights and so on, and their beauty and goodness. So our church is behind the eight ball on this. But as one of our callers there said, this is a hopeful sign.
Marianne, I do want to turn to you too, because I think often when we see an institution begin to change its stance, one of the things that is natural is to be angry for the legacy of the old stance. And I wonder, will we see and hear some of that alongside the excitement and those who will be angry with the church that this change is selling out to the traditions of the institution? I'd love your reactions to those thoughts.
I have certainly seen responses all across the board to this, from incredible jubilation and excitement about this to, you know, statements calling the Pope a heretic on this. And again, I think it points to the diversity within our church. I think that it is very important that we remain in dialogue with one another about this, that, you know, we continue to press for the church to honor the dignity and humanity of every person on earth, including our right to legal protections. And, you know, our organization actually believes that same-sex marriage should be considered sacramental in the same way that opposite-sex marriage should be. So I think that we need to be finding a place within our tradition, within our gospel stories, within our theology, for everyone to be equally embraced by the church. And again, I really hope that this is another step towards that reality.
Well, I'm so glad you've both been able to join us. Marianne Duddy Burke, Executive Director of Dignity USA, and Thomas Groom, Professor of Theology and Religious Education at Boston College. Thank you to both of you. Have you ever thought about the relationship between beauty and justice? You got to sit with it for a minute. But the idea that we can pair what is right with what is beautiful is really something. Mass Design Group's new book argues that justice is beauty. They're a nonprofit architecture firm focused on buildings for underserved populations. And in the past decade, they've created a hospital on a terraced hillside in Rwanda that reduces the spread of disease, a cholera treatment center in Haiti, which treats its own water, and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, commemorating victims of lynching in the U.S. Justice is Beauty, which chronicles those projects, is featured as a part of the Boston Book Festival this month, of which WBUR is a media partner. And we welcome now Michael Murphy, the founding principal and executive director of Mass Design Group. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
So, Michael, I couldn't read the book and I can't talk about the book and this relationship between how we define our physical environment and justice outside of the context right now of the coronavirus pandemic. So I think I want to ask you, I have to believe that at some moment when this pandemic began, you must have had a flashback or drew a connection between what is happening in this pandemic to some of your experience in working on these design and architectural projects in Haiti, Rwanda, or elsewhere. Was there that kind of flashback moment as this pandemic started to unfold?
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, absolutely. And I think probably most of us had a very similar moment. But for me, it was really the first week of March. I was just coming back from family leave. My son was born in late January, and my first trip was a flight to Los Angeles to give a lecture. And we were just starting to hear about the pandemic to our shores. And I remember flying to LA, being worried about the infection and knowing that there was that airflow could be a primary mode of transmission. And in the 3 days I was there, coming back through LAX and flying back to Boston, being the only one with a mask on, sitting in the plane, very, very concerned about the transmission, and having this real flashback to my time working in Rwanda in wards where tuberculosis, the airborne disease or multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, was transmitted in hallways and in other spaces, and being very afraid of contamination. And it clicked at that moment, you know, that it wasn't just hospitals where diseases are transferred. It wasn't just spaces that we know there's infections, but all the spaces around us, our houses, our schools, of course, our hospitals, our airports, are contagious if there is something in the air that can contaminate us, and that breathing is really a spatial problem, and our access to fresh air is a problem mitigated by the buildings around us.
Okay, that's terrifying. And in listening to you say it, I almost feel kind of short of breath. What did you do when you got home? How have you been working with that idea since March, when this revelation hit you on the airplane?
Well, I think it is terrifying, but it's also empowering. I mean, I think all of us in the world right now are going through a very similar spatial awakening. You know, we're looking at the walls around us and realizing that these systems that are supposed to introduce fresh air are not working as effectively as they could. Could we open windows? Could we protect our families in more effective ways? And that spatial awakening, I think, is a really profound shift in the way we think about our world, and because it gives us access to tools that we can change the buildings around us, change our ventilation systems, and change the way we understand air as a contaminating agent or a healing agent. And that's not just about the coronavirus. You start to think about air being contaminated with off-gassing or emissions or smoke, like we saw in the fires in California. Of course, carbon emitted into the atmosphere affecting neighborhoods. You know, these are, and our climate, these are all issues related to our ability to be around fresh air.
So let's begin to tie this now, Michael, to the thesis of this book, the manifesto as I read it from Mass Design Group, that justice is beauty. I'm going to ask you to read a little bit of the book. Our producer Zoe found this paragraph, and I remember when I read it, when I was reading the book, it struck me, especially in this context. It's on page 16, and it has to do with when you were building the cholera hospital in Haiti after a major outbreak there. Maybe you can read that for us.
Sure. It sometimes takes a disaster to reveal the fraying threads that undermine the social fabric of a community. In December 2011, cholera was that tear, uncovering the true infrastructural vulnerabilities of a country with so much of its building stock broken to begin with. The outbreak also revealed that it was not a lack of medical care or drugs or good intentions that paved Haiti's road to hell, but the very real and alarmingly limited number of working wastewater pipes that lay beneath it. What enabled cholera and crippled Haiti was a complete failure of the built environment.
Of course, hearing you write there about the fraying threads, the infrastructure vulnerabilities, the disproportionate impact that had on the poor and vulnerable in Port-au-Prince, for example, really brings home the data we consistently hear about the coronavirus and its disproportionate impact on vulnerable populations, people of color, low-income families. How do we begin to think about here this realization about our weakened infrastructure, of the vulnerabilities it creates, and what we can do different in our built environment? How do we begin to connect these dots?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, these epidemics, these challenges really stress our systems, and they reveal the cracks in those systems. We often say buildings heal or hurt. And here's an example of where we're seeing the built environment around us really hurt our public, the people most affected by the coronavirus. Of course, we're all affected by the coronavirus, but those most disproportionately affected are communities of color, but especially folks living in conditions like nursing homes, senior housing, incarcerated individuals, those within structures where they are most disenfranchised and unable to control the environment around them effectively. And this is a real concern that we should have, not just in addressing the kind of structural injustices in our community and advocating for those who are having trouble advocating for themselves in these conditions, but also thinking about the built environment that is encasing them, that they're suffering within. Can we redesign senior housing to breathe better, to be more effective, to be healing? Obviously, questions of incarceration surround us every day. We have to not just decarcerate our problem of mass incarceration, but think critically about spaces of detention, if we have them at all, and about how they're affecting people's health and their ability to live. All of these questions are interrelated with the buildings around us. And so designing spaces that are healing is about thinking about our physiological health, our sociological health, and also our environmental health.
All right. So now you've, with these spaces that are healing, you've taken us to the justice part. So now take us the next step to the beauty part. And maybe give us a story or a specific example from one of your designs.
You know, I think we have this, and there's this misunderstanding, I believe, in the way we evaluate buildings around us. We often talk about buildings as beautiful or sometimes ugly. Often, a lot of times, we talk about them as ugly. Or we talk about them as effective systems, good housing or poor housing. And we don't often talk about those things as interrelated, and that the choice between one or the others we really have found is a false choice. You know, all buildings affect our social, our environmental, and our political systems. The question is whether we really acknowledge that or not, and then are designing those systems to serve the public that they're in most effectively. And if we do so, this creates beauty, not just the form that we see, but the beauty is the perfect or the successful resolution of all of these systems coming together and serving the public in its most effective form. I really learned about this working in Rwanda with Dr. Paul Farmer, the great humanitarian designer. I'd call him really an architect himself and my first mentor of architecture. You know, and he talked about designing hospitals and building hospitals around the world, and he always focused on, this is a funny story, but he always would focus on the fish pond. It was always important that each medical facility had a fish pond. I always wondered why. He said to me once, you know, actually at the time, the Minister of Health of Mexico, Julio Frank, who ended up being the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, came to one of these facilities, and he came in, he saw the trees that Paul had spent so much time planting and the gardens and the fish pond, and he pronounced dignificación. This is the creation of dignity, the commitment and care to not just a facility that treats those with poor health or need treatment, but those that care about their whole being and their whole selves and creates beauty for them to repair in those spaces. That's a fundamental thing that the built environment is offering us at all times or taking away from us. And we should really focus on both of those things at once.
And just to note, you may have mentioned this, but Paul Farmer is the founder of Partners in Health, which I think was begun as a local organization here in the area. We have just a little bit of time left, Michael. Many of the spaces that Mass Design Group creates are communal. And you talk a lot about that in the book, Justice is Beauty. But we are now in a time when communal spaces have become not only almost irrelevant, but obsolete or anathema, at least for a while. Yeah. What does that mean? And what does it mean for your work?
You know, I think, you know, what you're talking about is really the public realm. And it's such an important thing for us to really think about right now, because the public realm is changing. It's changing in front of us, changing beneath our feet. It's shifting, but it's not going away. I wouldn't say it's being eradicated or erased. It's just changing. We're both seeing public realms that are being taken away from us. Let's say the restaurant, for example, is a form of public realm that few of us are going into. Of course, the theater or collective cultural spaces. But we're also seeing new public realms emerge. You know, the restaurant going out into the street and taking over new spaces that are providing that public realm again, where it's so necessary for us to gather. And we're seeing how essential it is for us as a public to gather, and how desperate we are to find that connection. I certainly feel it all the time, you know, staring at Zoom calls or on the computer, that we're not able to connect with each individuals in front of us, you know, see their muscles in their face change as we have a dialogue, or see them in person, or get to do things together. These are all, we're kind of like suffering in this isolation, and I think there's a desperate need for connectivity again. And one of the things I think the public realm forces us to do is consider who we are as a public and how we come together. You think about the Boston Common, for example, one of the great public realms in our country, and really one of the first public spaces is defined by that. And it's a very definition, the common, where we, our common needs and our common services are brought together and shared and navigated together under a shared collective needs and collective rights. This is essential for us as a public to sort of define ourselves and come together to advocate for what we need.
Well, that is Michael Murphy, an architect and the founding principal and executive director of Mass Design Group. The new book, Justice is Beauty, profiles the group's first 10 years. He'll be speaking on Friday at 7:30 as part of the Boston Book Festival, of which WBUR is a media partner. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Those are elementary school-age kids with Handel and Hayden Society's New Voices Choir. Of course, in this pandemic year, they couldn't be in the same room to sing. Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell has been reporting on innovative ways that members of New England's performing arts community are finding to keep making music together. And she brings us this story.
When conductor Nert Villani was faced with running a choir of 22 elementary school kids from all over Greater Boston, remotely, on Zoom, during a pandemic, she was unfazed.
I have this idea, no matter what is the distance, we can sing together.
And she was thinking bigger than the distance between Lynn and Alston.
And why not work together with another choir? And I'm thinking with my friends in my country, Colombia, why not work together?
Villani is the conductor for Handel and Haydn Society's New Voices Choir. She decided the choir's summer season and final concert would be a joint production with another choir nearly 3,000 miles away in her hometown, Popayán, Colombia.
We give both choirs the opportunity to explore the other language first.
Popayán had tougher stay-at-home orders than Massachusetts to limit the spread of the coronavirus. So Villani's two friends, Maria Teresa Potes and Felipe Estrada, were facing the exact same challenges running the Titita Children's Choir.
In this time, with the people stay inside, give some happiness and feel not alone inside. Feel we share something, we still alive and make music.
For Angelette Dorvalas-Gideon, a mother of two in Lynn, the program was a godsend.
It was very hard for me because we could not go anywhere. All our vacation was canceled. So when I received the email, I'm like, oh, guys, there's a choir. You want to sing? They all say, yeah, we're singing.
But it is practically impossible for 22-plus people to sing together in any language on Zoom. Villani says a lot of the work was done by children and their families independently. Gideon's daughter, 9-year-old Olivia Bernice Gideon, says she preferred the at-home innovations.
At first, I thought it was going to be really hard, but then it was really easy because I don't like singing in front of people. So when you have a camera and then you send it to them, I thought it was more easier instead of singing in front of people.
Seven-year-old Tanoshi Inamata from Alston loved the opportunity to learn a new language.
Yes, I was very excited.
Each week, Villani would send a portion of one song for the kids to learn in Spanish, and they would record themselves performing it and send it back to her. The choir in Colombia did the same, but with English. Tanoshi said it wasn't always easy.
Kind of difficult.
What was kind of difficult about it?
The pronunciation.
Villani says this challenge was something everyone had to grapple with.
We have the same challenge to learn them because they have the challenge for English, and here we have the challenge for the Spanish and the rhythms.
In the end, Tanoshi says he took to the language in a big way, learning entire compositions in Spanish, and he practiced hard. For the kids, it was also a chance to make new friends while stuck at home. Tanoshi showed me letters he received from his new friends in Colombia.
They eat a little dumpling that has vegetables in it called empanaditas. And they also sometimes dance together.
Here's what Olivia learned.
I learned that it has volcanoes there and the people speak Spanish.
Olivia's little brother, Carter Gavin Gideon, age 7, was nervous about connecting with kids far away.
Because I don't know many people, and I don't know if I can make new friends at new schools or other friends from somewhere different.
But Carter found that in the end, it wasn't intimidating, and he learned something.
That everybody is good how they made, and everybody should be nice to each other.
For conductor Nert Villani, that lesson is what this experiment was ultimately about.
Really, we don't have difference between the kids here and the kids there. They have many different opportunities, but the desire to learn, to enjoy, to make music, not change, it's the same.
But something does change. Some kind of magic happens when you put kids together on a project. Remember that song Tanoshi was practicing?
That story from Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Engineers today are Marquise Neal and Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.